But yeah, Madagascar.
Da
Madagascar. You can
da
imagine. You can imagine that
da
Madag. That's it, man. I hope we didn't violate any copyright rules there with that song,
not with
Tim.
me trying to sing.
Well, the one thing I can say is that I do have high-speed internet, man. I have super high-speed internet here. It's really, really cool. And all right, welcome everybody. Welcome. Good to have you all here. I would tell you that no matter what, it's good to have you here, and I'm glad you're here. I'm in my new digs, but next week it'll look a little bit differently. So right now it is the way it's going to look. But I got some greenery in the background, which is really great. I'm in a city now called Wahin. But before we go into that, I want to welcome everybody to our 203rd consecutive meeting, Thinking Out Loud with Friends. And today we are talking about, now it's getting interesting. So it's going to continue getting interesting, interesting. But before we go into any of the subjects that I wanted to cover today, who here wants to say something that's on their mind? So welcome. Ah, that was, yeah, there you
Cheers,
go. Cheers, my friends. Cheers. So, Dave Brown, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on the panel. I think you know everybody, maybe with the exception of Wayne Sims from Australia.
to see you all. Please excuse during this time of day. I teach radio class, two-way radio class. And down in transit during rescheduled, so I'm able to jump in.
GMRF or what kind of two-way radio?
Ham, what depends.
Oh man, your audio signal is breaking up like crazy. Sorry to say that. You might be
Oh,
on Wi-Fi, and that could be the problem.
no, definitely hardwired. Nothing beats wire.
Ah, there you go. Now you're better. Now you're there.
Coming in
Different.
and
Oh
out.
my
He's coming
God,
in and out, Dave. Sorry to say.
Mike Brown, Mr. Cavlo himself has
Oh,
popped
Mike
into the
Brown is
room.
in the room. That's crazy.
What
But
the
Dave,
hell?
wait. So that are you related? Mike Brown, Dave Brown. What the hell? And Dave
No, I
Brown.
just finished my taxes. I'm pretty sure not.
So
And he's
Dave,
not even the right Dave Brown.
what bands do you operate on, Dave?
Pretty well. I've got a general license, so everything. But yeah, we start them off with F for beginning. Box get General Mobile Radio Service, GMRS. But our objective is to get licensed as many hands we can, and we will pay for introductory radio, not a cheap old Baofeng or anything like that. A proper Icom, Motorola, whatever, Yaesu, and 100 hams that we've gotten licensed. Just one quick story is there was this lady that I know who
Unfortunately, you're breaking up like crazy, and
Yeah, Dave, I want to hear about that because my father was a very avid ham radio operator. He started with his general license and worked on it. Bruce Fowles is here. Anyway,
yeah, speaking of
he worked up to
hams,
advanced. He worked up to
speaking of ham
advanced.
radio,
But
unbelievable, Bruce
he's no
Fowles.
longer with us, but I would really love to get into ham radio again.
It's real
Do
easy.
you know? Anyway, we need to fix your audio though, Dave. Your audio is really
Yeah,
not good.
well,
It's muffled for the most part, and then when it well, sometimes it cuts out, which is a
well,
bummer. But great to
shouldn't
see you, Bruce.
be. Okay, any better audio?
Good to see you guys too.
Hey, there you go.
I was on a Zoom meeting with the Zoom people for a show next month in New York, so we just got done. I looked up at the clock. I said, "Oh my God, I have a Zoom with people that aren't Zoom."
Well, we have
Because
John Edelson in the room
well,
right
where
now,
did he
by the
go? I
way.
don't see him any longer. Oh, there he is. There's John. John is the Mr. Zoom.
Well,
Yeah, well,
I'm a daddy
he's
of a
father to
Zoom
Mr.
guy,
Zoom.
but I wasn't
And
really a doctor. I
you
was
know what's
client number three.
special about today's version of John? It's not the amazingly smart, I wish I had thought of it, pre-recorded version of John that we have seen before.
He's probably getting ready to go to NAB, right?
Oh, Ken, you never noticed, did you? John recorded himself sitting in front of his webcam and then would just play it back on loop during meetings. So it looked like his camera was on, but it wasn't.
You've outed me, Mike. But I'm not going to NAB this year.
It was, and I got to tell you, I was suspicious after a couple of episodes, and then I watched for like three, and you were really, really good about sitting nearly perfectly still. I was impressed. I was like, you know what? I could never do this. I could never sit that still, not move my hand, not scratch my face, nothing. Just sit that. It was amazing.
We had to hone our skills for the office hours show because Alex was a demanding son of a bitch in this respect. And so we all had to define how to get the loop system going so it didn't look like a loop system. So we wouldn't get kicked off the panel.
Ken is still like flabbergasted.
That's quite an achievement, I think.
Hey, we're getting pretty popular, by the way, guys. I mean, like last week, I believe that we got 9 new subscribers. 9 new subscribers, and this is amazing, and it's not all me or you, but the show's been watched 1,726 minutes for a total view of 1,542 total views. It is blowing my mind. So congratulations, everybody. People really are starting to enjoy what we're saying. And speaking of which, hey, Bruce, what's on your mind?
I just have to get my unmute button. Not much. Just keeping busy. For an old retired guy, I've been unusually busy.
About that,
something
huh?
tells me you have an eclipse story. I'm sure you've got an eclipse story in it. And
actually,
how you're recycling your eclipse glasses.
Actually, no, I don't. Everybody emailed me and texted me and said, oh, what are you doing? Did you see the eclipse? Is there something going on? And I was like, I didn't even know. I was over at the other house dealing with a roofing guy, and I was running around yesterday doing all kinds of stuff and totally forgot the eclipse was even happening, to be honest with you. On the other hand, my wife was at the Beverly Hills courthouse. And they all walked outside, and a couple of the bailiffs had glasses that I guess were okay to watch, and they had these cameras, and they did the. She's sending me all these pictures, while I'm dealing with all this other stuff. So she got to see it, and I didn't. So I totally forgot it was even happening.
Wow, it must have been pretty impressive to actually see it in real life. But of course you couldn't see it. You couldn't see it, but then there was a point where the corona came out. At one point you could take off the glasses and look.
My daughter.
Dallas, I was in Fort Worth and got to see it live, had the glasses.
And my daughter's in San Antonio and she watched it. She texted me right away and said, oh my God, it got so dark here. So you were in Dallas and it got you too? Well, did it get
actually,
dark?
I was in Fort Worth. Dallas was a little closer to the center, but we were able to see it for about 2 minutes and 30 seconds, the full eclipse, and it got cooler. The animals made different sounds. And then when the total.
Really?
It was pretty amazing because all the street lights went on, all the automatic lights went on. It was quite a ethereal experience.
The earth did not end.
Tell me more about the animal. The animals. So, what animals did you see do what?
Now, were these two-legged animals or four-legged animals? That's what I want to know.
We'll get in. No, but it was actually the sounds that the birds made. We also had some dogs that were there, that were pets from the human owners. And you could tell they were somewhat confused at the change of the time zone. I think they thought they were supposed to get treats when the sun went down, and it didn't happen.
Well, it looked like someone took a bite out of a cookie. That's really all we saw.
I was in Vegas, and we saw that. I felt like I was looking at the crescent moon, but it was the crescent sun,
Right.
Yeah, and you're sure it wasn't the sphere you were looking at?
I'm pretty sure. Corey gave me a pair of really dark glasses. I put them on and I'm like, wow, look at that. It's a crescent sun.
I wonder if the sphere showed the eclipse. That would have been interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder.
Well, we haven't seen it anywhere yet, so.
It would have been 90 milliseconds late, though.
For sure.
They can just do a digital eclipse, right, Kurt?
Sure they could.
Analog eclipses are warmer.
That's pretty funny.
I got to tell you, I'm pretty excited, speaking of the sphere. They are seriously considering my idea for one of the screensavers.
And that was?
A ball of yarn, and then once in a while, a cat's paw will come out and bat it.
And it'll ping pong around from the cat?
No, the whole thing's a ball, so you'll kind of see it roll away, and then you'll see the cat's face, and then it'll reset.
Oh, and, interesting. And
did you submit that to somebody?
Yes, I have a couple friends that work there, and they passed it on to the graphics people, and then one of them called me.
Oh, that is awesome. Congratulations if that happens.
That'll be my 15 minutes of fame.
Wow, that's great. Pretty impressive.
You got to get a video of it when it happens.
Video of a video. Huh.
Yeah, exactly.
A video
yeah.
of a video. Of you standing in front of the video. There you go. Hey, I'm just curious to know, how was Cablo Nashville?
Cablo Nashville was really, really strong. It went logistically, we had some challenges, like we always do, but it didn't help this time that, like, load-in day, there was a tornado watch. So the trucking companies stopped, like, they just pulled over. They're like, yeah, we don't drive during tornado watches, which I, you know, makes sense, but you're trying to build a trade show floor and you need the gear. The Gaylord was horrible to deal with. I mean, the people are super, super nice, but their policies are not good.
I don't like any of the Gaylords, to be honest with you.
I
want to interrupt. Everything you hear today is an opinion, so do your own research. All right, now, what about
And I
you
was just going to say, I much prefer the straight lords than the Gaylords, you know?
Yeah. Well, though there's nothing wrong with that, really nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, I've always wanted to say something sarcastic like that. You just did it for me, so thank you.
Yeah.
$37 a day parking with no in and out.
Oh, stupid, yes.
You know, the exhibitor's lunch, you know, box lunch, I typically spend, depending on the venue, somewhere between 25 and 35. They were 72 for less product.
Wow.
That's a huge increase. Wow.
Yeah, it's just every opportunity they had. And, you know, then stupid stuff. Like, I negotiated that we would have direct access to the two docks that were behind our space. And I was surprised. Problem. Then later they were like, yeah, by the way, you have to pay for security for the docks. And I'm like, what? You said I could have the docks. They're like, yes, the docks you have. We included those for free, just not the security. And that ended up being $2,100.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the ballrooms in the Gaylords, you know, they have a lot of them have the stages at one end, and I've done a ton of stuff in those ballrooms. I did the grand opening of the one on the Potomac, and we had all this entertainment. It was all, like, stupid. And I did Mohawk carpets in there a couple times, and we had all these huge surround systems for their opening videos with 360-foot screens. And all these ballrooms, I think, I don't know how they build them, but this is what I imagine. They're all steel, thin steel walls with nothing behind them, and then they put wallpaper on them. So they, when you bang on them, they sound like these hollow tea cans, old tea kettles that you put on a stove, and the whole room just resonates this nasty, you know, nastiness through the whole gig.
I attribute that to architects, right? Don't architects call those shots?
Yeah, but, you know, the architects never talk to the people that actually do shit in the ballroom.
Well,
you know?
Try working in some of the arenas in the world, and then talk about architects. Oh my God, yeah. Give me a break.
Yeah, arenas are horrid.
Mike, for your next show, I'll come down and cook lunch and watch the dock for less.
Well, you won't have to go very far.
I know what I'm saying.
Oh, so the word is out?
Well,
yeah, that's good money, right?
Yeah.
Well, and what's funny about that whole thing is I know, generally speaking, you know, obviously every property could be a little bit differently, but generally speaking, at any given hotel, security is the lowest paid position. And if it's not the lowest paid position, it's bottom two or three, because most of even like your porters and housekeeping, busboys, that sort of stuff, they're unionized in a lot of these properties. So they actually make more, but there's, but security workers a lot of times aren't unionized. So that's what was so infuriating, that I was paying $68 an hour for somebody that they're probably paying $15 an hour to, would be my guess.
You know, the hotel employees in Los Angeles, I did the HERE conferences for a bunch of years, and that's the hotel, like the people that clean your room. Back in the probably the mid, early 2000s when I was did their shows for about 3 years, they were making $29 an hour then. I fell over, you know, with benefits and everything when I, you know, it's like, okay, you know, pay them good, but really $30 an hour in 19, you know, in 2010 or whatever it was. I couldn't believe it.
Probably the big capper was when I walked in. So mind you, I never host a Cablo without having visited the venue. I almost always wait to sign the contract until I visit the venue, because you just never know. The pictures on the website are always taken, like, you know, while the paint is still wet.
Yeah.
Right after the building was built, before anybody had ever used it, you know. So I want to actually see it and smell it and kind of get a feel for the people and look at the loading dock, you know, is it full of trash and is the dumpster overflowing and, you know, all that stuff, right? So I went to the Gaylord in December and walked the space. And one of the things that was different about this venue than any other venue we've used is we weren't in a ballroom. We were in the actual Ryman Exhibit Hall, which is a typical exhibit space, bare concrete floor, not truly clear space because they have columns every 30 feet, but it was our most convention-y kind of space that we've ever used. So one of the things that was new to me was that I was going to have to order carpet. We've always done ballrooms, so I don't have to order carpet. So I got a quote from a carpet vendor, carpet rental place there in Nashville, and they wanted $3 a square foot plus for the space, which worked out to about $18,000. And I said, well, how about if we just do the booths? Well, that would be $12,000. Well, I'm a bright boy, right? I had an idea. So I bought a whole bunch of rugs from the company that makes the rugs that you can buy at Home Depot, like area rugs, right? And their mill is right there in Georgia, about 2 hours away. So it was perfect. And then I arranged to donate them to Habitat for Humanity after the show, which,
wow,
in my mind, since they've only at that point got about a day and a half usage on them, I still think they're new from a tax deduction point of view. So anyway, we get there. I fly in on the 31st, last Sunday, and I don't get to the property till about 6 in the evening. So I just go straight to my room. I've got some work to do anyway. I get that done. And then 6 a.m., I'm down at the exhibit hall, just, you know, double checking. We're supposed to load in on Tuesday. So Monday morning, I want to double check, make sure things are happening, go over the power plan because they're going to install power on Monday. And I open the door and it's carpeted. 3-4 weeks earlier, they had carpeted the space and not told me.
Jesus. So
I had to refuse the two rug shipments because they were already well on their way by then. I'm going to have to pay for the return freight. I'm going to have to pay a restocking fee. And so I'm actually, I don't know if anybody from the Gaylord is watching. We're going to talk about that, Gaylord. I'm going to take that off the top of the bill because I emailed you. I emailed Gaylord saying, hey, I've got carpet orders coming to cover up the bare floor, and no one said a word. Like, hey.
And they didn't charge extra for that carpeting.
No, it's permanent. Assume. It's permanent.
Oh, permanent. Yeah, but they didn't tell you.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
So it leaves me with only one question. How much money did you lose this weekend?
It actually, I just got the final bill today. And I think if they give a little bit, and I hammered on them while I was there, and my guests were unhappy. The signage was horrible. The food was overpriced. A lot of my exhibitors just hammered on them about what a terrible experience it was. Bosch came this close to sending an email out telling all their people worldwide, don't ever stay at a Marriott again. And that actually helped me resolve a couple of issues, was that threat. So I've actually had to send a little thank you note to my contact at Bosch, because that, you know, 82,000 people not staying at Marriott kind of got their attention.
Is the Gaylord part of the Marriott?
Yeah, Marriott.
It is now. Yeah, it is now. Back.
Marriott, okay. For the longest time, Marriott was a partner. They ran the hotel operations, and then Gaylord ran everything else. And then Marriott out and out bought Gaylord a few years back. But yeah, it was, I'll never call another Gaylord again. And it might even be a while before I go to another Marriott again. It was not a fun experience every day, just battling them on stuff. But
so did you get a good tax loss? That's all I could say. You got a good tax loss, big write-off this year.
We had 50 booths, 59 brands were exhibiting. We co-located with another conference called the Wave Conference, and they do reg a little bit differently. So I'm still trying to get to like a really good number to put out there to the world. But I'm guessing between the two of us, we had a little over 400 register, and probably about 220 to 240 actually show up and walk the show floor. My Cav Lounge, which is the free food and drink throughout the day of the show, was a big hit. People love that. Nobody guessed what Cavlo stands for, so that'll roll over to Seattle on October.
Is there money involved in the win?
Yes.
Yeah, all you got to do is Google it. What does it mean? It comes right up.
C-A-V-L-O, Cavlo?
Yeah.
You talked about this.
Mike rolled his eyes when Jan said that, so you know that's not true, obviously. It's just an opinion of Jan. Just an opinion.
Exactly. Yeah.
I will say this. Three more people. So going into this, so anyway, to finish your answer, you're answering your question, Bruce. Yes. I add $500 to the kitty every show that no one guesses correctly.
Wow.
So I really need someone to guess correctly soon.
So it's not commercial audio, video, and lighting organization?
It is not that. That is it. That's probably the number one guess.
Wow.
Now, going into this show, we had three people ever who had gotten 4 out of 5. At this show, we picked up 4 more. So now we're at 7. And one person finally got the hardest one, or the one that no one else has ever gotten, the one letter. If they just figure it out, if they ever put it all together. But they were local to Nashville, so I, you know, in 2 years, maybe they won't even show up. I really just can't. It can't go on forever. I don't want to get to like 5 years from now and it's, you know, $8,000 I got to give somebody.
What's the Seattle?
Wow, $8,000. Just think about the guy that just won $1.3 billion in a lottery. You know, I mean, hey.
Unbelievable.
Like you can compare the two. Cavlo naming what Cavlo means and getting the money out of you. Or $1.3 billion from the state of whatever the lottery.
And they didn't even have to figure anything out. They just bought some tickets.
But that guy will be broke in 5 years.
Yes.
Or commit suicide.
Yeah. And they won't make him send any money to freaking Ukraine either.
So what's the date for Seattle? October what?
October 10th.
The day after John Lennon's birthday.
Oh, let me add that to my master calendar.
And what would the timeline be to exhibit?
I've taken exhibitors before the day before a show. I've literally had somebody call me at 3 o'clock on load-in day and saying, hey, you got any booths left? The answer, by the way, to that question is always yes. Yes, we do.
Yeah.
And I assume the exhibitors pay you to exhibit. Is that how it works?
That's
your fourth source of income, I assume.
Yeah, because no one else pays for anything. The food is free, attendance is free, classes are free, everything's free. Exhibitors foot the bill.
Well, then you get what you pay for. If everything's free, there you go.
That's a Thursday. Like that. It's really 10th, October 10th.
Yes, sir. That is a Thursday.
And it's all just one day.
Yep. Well, we'll load in on Wednesday. We always either do Tuesday, Wednesday, or Wednesday, Thursday. And venue availability in the Seattle area is about as tricky as it is in Nashville. So we'll actually be in Lynnwood. We'll be at the Lynnwood Convention Center.
Oh, have you been there?
I have not.
You have not?
I have not.
Arguably one of the worst sounding, relatively new buildings I've ever been in my life.
Thank God we're not doing a concert.
It's, well, the cacophony of what's going to roll around above the corrugated steel ceiling in there is going to drive you nuts.
What venue is this?
The Lynnwood Convention Center, just north of Seattle. If it makes it sound like there's more people in there, I'm all for it.
Oh, it'll definitely do that.
Wait a second. I think
you, is it carpeted?
Kurt, I think you got the first letter of Cavlo. Cacophony. What would you say?
Cacophony.
Or maybe it stands for carpet.
It'd be chaos.
Yeah, that's a good. You know what? That's a good question. I better ask. Is it carpeted?
Is that the convention center? Is that the convention center that sort of straddles the hillside and the freeway right there? It kind of shelves up.
No, that's in Seattle. That's the Seattle Convention Center.
Some
brilliant person decided to build right over the I-5.
I thought that was so weird.
So you can never expand
I-5. Architects, you're the best ever.
Who would have predicted traffic would increase?
My gosh, really? It's increasing?
Yeah. But that convention center is okay. It's just, if like we tried to do a corporate event in there, and the guy speaking from the stage would be, you'd still hear him, 5 minutes later.
10 minutes later.
It was not good. And a very like fluttery, that like the lots of, mid-time reflections. So it's just past comb filtering and barely delay.
It's funny, we did in 1981, I think, was the Boeing 757 reveal, and it was a 3-week build and a 3-hour show and a 4-day strike, and we built it in the big airplane hangar in Renton, which they were building like 10 airplanes at the same time while we were setting up this freaking show.
Was it Renton or Everett?
I think it was Renton.
Because Everett is where they normally do them, and that's literally the largest enclosed building in the world.
This is like a mile long or something. This building was freaking huge. We pulled the plane out of a cloud into the audience. It was one of the coolest things I ever saw. It was, it was a couple tractor trailers of just show plastic to encompass the plane, in some kind of stage. And then, oh my God, we had like 14 dry ice fog machines, and we had about 20. Chemical fog machines, and we literally, we lit up the fog like it was the sun coming up, and pulled the plane out of the fog down into the audience, and they went nuts. But anyway, the funny part about that was the third day of the strike, when we closed the door on the truck, the saying was, we could still hear "thank you for coming" echoing in the damn room 3 days after the show ended.
We did a rollout or a delivery for the Sultan of someplace. I don't remember who it was. Somebody bought a plane. They painted it orange, which pissed off everybody because Boeing planes are always blue when they're delivered. And so like the staff was mad. We had 6 hangs of Meyer line array. And
you wouldn't believe what I used.
Hundreds of feet between them. Yeah. And it took a week to put it in. And I'll never forget, one of the rigs came from Arizona, I think. I don't remember who it was. I had 2 of the 6, and then there were some from out of town. And the main hang, they started trying to rig it, and they had forgotten the pins that attach the pickup grid to the top box. They were in Arizona, literally. And so they're like, okay, well, they're going to get a guy with a little anvil briefcase, and they're going to get him a quick ticket and get him on a plane. And we're all going to stand around for, 6 hours or whatever it takes for him to get to the airport, get on a flight, get to SeaTac, get up to the place and everything. And I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, hang on. Those pins come from the aircraft industry. So
I think they'd have them there, wouldn't you?
I found a guy on a big Cushman cart with and I'm like, do you have any of these or something like this? And he goes, oh, yeah.
Right, thousands back. Right, thousands.
Yeah, so he goes and he gets in this Cushman cart. He comes back like 20 minutes later with this cart that's like 3 times the size of a golf cart, and it's got a whole wooden bin on it that somebody built in the machine shop in probably 1972 or something. and it's completely full with thousands of rigging pins. Thousands of them. Man. Every size you could possibly
imagine. Don't they call them Averback pins? Is that correct? Is that the name?
I don't know. I know they were invented for the air cargo handling, is what they originally came from. But
usually whenever I have a question like that, Christopher comes right up with the answer. Well,
so the guy shows up and we just AB them, and there's exactly those pins. Same diameter, same length, all of that stuff. So I'm like, you're in one of the two places in the world, which would be the Airbus factory or the Boeing factory, where you could forget the pins and you're going to be good. And then the guy hooked him up with like 20. He's like, take some spares. It's fine. And he gave him like...
Those are expensive pins.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He gave him like $1,000 pins or $2,000 with the pins, and nobody even cared.
So you guys,
that was the day before the Boeing was losing parts like crazy. Now we understand what's going on. I mean, another near catastrophe of Boeing.
And they weren't bolts.
What?
Yeah, I was going to say they're not used in doors, are they?
Yeah, they weren't bolts.
Yeah.
Oh, so I think the name you were looking for, Jan, is Avdel, AVDEL.
I always thought it was called Averback. Averback pins, but that's what I was always. But you know what? It's an opinion. What do I care? You know. So the reality is, Boeing, this Southwest Airlines, just lost another cowl on an engine. I mean, that's crazy. Really?
Wow.
Yeah. On Southwest.
So
Boeing, Boeing is like dying. It's bad.
The problem is that Boeing doesn't even make the engines, and Southwest is in charge of the maintenance. So every time something happens, people mention Boeing again. And they're getting a bad rap that they don't deserve.
That's exactly.
Oh, they deserve it. They deserve it.
What they need to move the corporate. They had back here.
They deserved it for the door on the Alaska plane, didn't they, David?
Yeah, but they made a legal settlement. That's not enough to take out a company that's that big. You know, you're talking about
it was enough to take out all the top executives.
Yeah, 12 of them or something?
It was never like this before they moved corporate headquarters to Chicago. And there's a push now to get them to move it back to Seattle where it belongs.
Yeah, it's because stock price over safety. That's the problem right there, right?
I think it's shareholder payments, maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is that people focus on short-term profits rather than long-term growth, and Ken's exactly spot on there. And they're looking for stock price, they're looking for all this stuff, and what happens down the road, they don't give a flying F.
Well, yeah, David's right.
Or they're trying to give money back to the stockholders by buying back shares.
It depends what situation you're in, but I have friends that are in the world of tech where they've got PE, you know, and they're in round five of, you know, of funding, and they're getting ready to go public. And what happens inside these companies, they just put them through the ringer. I mean, they really don't care. All they want is the pop on the IPO, and whatever happens to you after that is your good fortune or misfortune, and they could roundly give an F, except if they're bound under whatever that rule is in the SEC, which they can't sell their own, you know, they can't sell the stock immediately. But
if only there was an example of this in the current news cycle that we could refer to.
Unbelievable. I watch it. The curve is going straight down. Another scam by a scam artist. Unbelievable. You know, P.T. Barnum said it best. There's a sucker born every minute and two to take them. And this is amazing what's going on in the market today.
So not to get back to audio, but on my Boeing show in 1980, you guys...
Boeing,
you guys will appreciate this. I had a PM1000 32-channel, PM1000, and I had 60 Stanley Screamers with Crown DC-300s. Who can relate to that?
Yeah, baby. David has been there.
Yeah,
do you know that if you had a PM1000 today, it would be worth
a fortune?
Unbelievable.
With those beautiful wood sides, man.
Oh, yeah, but more importantly, they wanted the preamps.
And
they they want the preamps for the recording studios. Using the
PM1000 or 2000?
Yeah.
No, I think it's the 2000. I think it's the 2000.
Why would anyone want a Yamaha preamp for a recording studio?
Yeah, listen.
Yeah.
I just before the
do
pandemic
your own research.
We put two PM1000s on every website we could find, listing we could find. At one point, we had somebody offering us $800 just for the power supplies. That's all he wanted. And we ended up, that's what we sold. We sold two of them for $800 so the guy could just get the power supplies. The consoles we pushed into a dumpster.
Oh, that's a sin.
Yeah,
come
that's
on.
A sin.
Nobody wanted them. Literally, no one.
So, did you consider pulling the modules out of them and saving the modules?
No.
Okay. So my 1000 was customized by John Wendt.
John Wendt, yeah, he was doing it up then.
Oh
to
my
do
God!
What,
yes.
A monitor console.
No, so well, if you remember other than the matrixes, the four matrix outputs, the console had unbalanced quarter inch outputs on the back. And it also had echo sends. Remember the gray knobs that were pre-fade echo sends? So I had John Wendt router little slots under each echo send, and he put in switches so that my echo sends were pre-post changeable. And I had all the outputs on the console. He put Jensen transformers in and balanced all the outputs. So my console was hot-rodded.
Hot-rodded. Oh, and totally.
And you know what? It sounded really damn good.
Who owned that? Was that AVHQ or something?
No, Staging Techniques. It was their only console we had. It was the console I started the office with in 1980. And then, you know, John Wendt designed the 3K, and we had
PM 3000.
What is it? Number 10 of the 3000s, because we got it through John Wendt.
It was too bad. They really scrimped out on that 3000, though. That was not a good move.
The 3000 was their
worst console ever.
The whole thing, after a couple of years of going in and out of trucks, the whole frame got twisted and all the joints came, so cold solder joints, you know, and we started to have all kinds of problems with it after about 5 years. And that was, it was such a bummer.
Because the 2000, the 1000 and 2000 were very solid and very high quality audio.
The 2000 had the concentric knobs, right? The stack them up
EQ?
Knobs.
You mean for
yeah,
EQ?
Yeah, yeah.
For EQ, if I remember, but it was all 60 dB steps on the mic preamp. But yeah. My point is that they really lost it with the 3000. They went for budget over quality, and it was like, oh, what a horrible console that was. And then, relatively speaking, and then the 4000, they kind of resurrected their image.
Well, I had a 4K and two 3500s for a while, and the 3500s lasted pretty well. And then when I started,
they're good.
The 4K was the last one I had at Staging Techniques. And then, that's what we had at AVHQ for the longest time. And then when I started working with you at Video Apps, you know, you guys had the Soundcraft MH4s? Is that what they were?
Yeah, because they were $2 less than the Yamaha.
Is that what it was? But I liked those.
I'm sure it was budget-driven. It was budget-driven. Maybe not $2, but, you know, it was probably half the price of a PM4000.
Trey had Series 5s. God, and I loved
those. Those were nice. Those were nice, yeah.
They were, other than the fact that you had to pull them with a tractor trailer, they were so damn huge. But, you know.
They weren't as big as the one that wouldn't fit sideways in the truck. Which one was that?
ATI
Vienna
Paragon.
Or something?
ATI Paragon.
No, I'm talking about a Soundcraft.
Yeah, the sound, right, the Soundcraft had one that was huge.
Yeah, we began with.
Yeah, here's this guy.
Whatever the letter V was, it wasn't
Vienna.
It might have been.
You're right, Raphael.
I think it's
Vienna was a smaller console, wasn't it?
Yeah,
maybe
right. Vienna was a big. The ATI Paragon was the biggest console I've ever seen. That was for a touring.
So have you guys seen? There's this guy that mixes front of house for. Now I can't remember his name, but he has a small frame Paragon, small frame ATI Paragon. Well, relatively small. It's not that big. Wayne Pauly, right. Have you seen that, his console?
It's weird. He's got a left-hand master somehow.
It was custom made. That console was supposedly custom made for resorts in Atlantic City.
Really?
That's what I think I read somewhere, yeah.
Shadone has the Stones monitor console when they used Paragon for that. And he says it's mint, perfect, and it's got like 48 outs or something because they had to do the wedge lines that went all the way down the ego ramp and all that stuff, you know. So they had all these outputs.
48, wow.
48 outs.
Analog too.
Claire Brothers has the Rolling Stones monitor console.
So, Bruce,
yes, Claire Brothers, sure, by association now has that console. But
sorry, Dave, I missed that. What was that?
Yeah.
You had the 1000. Did John Wynn put those four knobs on top where the subgroup switches were?
Yes.
So,
Eddie he balanced. Had shadow switches for assignments, and he did the monitor console version where it was, what, four pots instead of four switches, right?
I had the knobs, and I also had pre-post switches under each knob. Pre-post
switches, yeah, that's killer.
Yeah, and then it was all balanced, too, because those damn consoles didn't have balanced outputs. But
interesting. I don't remember that, but that's cool.
Well, he did it for me. I don't know how many of them he did. I would imagine it was a great idea. I would hope that he would have done more, you know, for, you know, you guys. But he
didn't. John Wynn get involved with the Ramza too?
Yes, he did.
He was very much involved in Ramza. Yeah.
I think the A52 was one of his designs, which was a sweet ass desk. It was it's pain in the ass moments, but for the most part. But he did a line of Ramza amplifiers, and he did a Fender line too. Fender. Remember the Golden Bear in Huntington Beach?
Oh, sure. God, yes.
Right. The Golden Bear had a Fender front of house console and Fender amplifiers. And they used to call me occasionally to fill in there. And what I hated about that place is you have to go up the freaking ladder to get up to the front of house console. But you know, we did Lee Ritenour in there and Billy Cobham and all these super great jazz guys in there. And all the Ramsa stuff was all Fender, you know, stuff by John Wendt, you know, like prototype stuff, but the system sounded pretty good. I was pretty happy with it.
You know, a little side story, and when the Huntington Beach renovation came to fruition, they moved the Golden Bear into the mall building that they tore it down, and then it built. And mm-hmm. on top of it was the
they
movie
moved the
theater.
Golden Bear. It was a fail.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
And then basically, whenever they would have a concert, the people in the movie theater couldn't hear the movie. And then also the movie theater would interfere with the concert sound over there. I don't know whatever happened with that. Does anybody know?
We had something similar in Dallas Fort Worth. There was a nightclub in the early 90s I helped build called Iguana Mirage. And it was a big top 40 hip hop club. And it was in the, what is that? There's a mall right off Greenville Avenue, Loop 12, Neiman Marcus, Macy's. It's kind of the higher end mall at the time. And so this was a big club. I mean, I think it held around 1,200 people legally. So we probably had 2,000 people in on any given weekend. And it was built under the AMC theaters. In the mall, you went all the way up to the third level to enter the movie theaters, you know, and then they pitched down. So you'd be at second level and the lower levels. And it was, you know, it didn't occur to anyone to think about, you know, is this a good idea? because, it, you know, Dallas isn't like Vegas. You know, in Vegas, the nightclubs don't open till 11. So it would probably work fine. In Dallas, nightclubs open at 8 because they have to close at 2 because that's when the last call is, right? So it was bad. And, but everybody, you know, it was... The nightclub was like, listen, I signed a 5-year lease. I gave you a year in advance of rent. You know, you knew what I was doing. I told you what I was doing. That's not my problem. So the one weekend, the movie theater, I think it was AMC, people came to town just finally to try and settle this out. And this was only like our fourth weekend in business, I think. And they asked Keith, the owner of the club, they said, so listen, what do you got into this? And he said, oh, I got at least $1.5 million, $2 million. And of course, you know, 1991, 92, that's a chunk of change.
That's a shitload of money, yeah.
Yeah. And they said, okay, we'll cover that.
Did they buy him out?
And oh, he said, what? Man. And they were like, yeah, $2 million. And you shut down and go away.
Go away. Wow.
And he was like, all right, well, it just... I guess, you know, wire me the money and I'll tell my staff this is our last weekend. And the guy was like, no, you don't understand. And he pulled a check out of his folded up check out of his suit pocket. And he wrote it right there, $2 million. And he said, you're closed right now. And it was like an 8:30, 8:45 on a Friday evening.
And who was the entertainment that night?
That one was just, we didn't have any, we didn't have just like a local guest DJ or anything. Just local, whatever. DJ, right? And Keith literally walked out and he said, all right, everybody, we're done. And everybody's like, what? We're closing?
Holy night?
So now he had $2 million in his pocket. What did he end up going to do? Did he build another club or did he retire?
Here's what's even crazier. He gets a call. So anyway, he tells everybody, no, we're done. I just sold the club. We're closed for good. Sorry. Y'all help yourself to whatever's in the cooler behind the bar. And I'll pay the bill. So people were literally walking out with armfuls of liquor bottles, which is big time illegal in Texas. You can't do that. They did it anyway. He didn't care. So he shuts down, right? That's it. Club's over. He gets a call from the landlord like a month later saying, hey, man, when are you moving out? And he's like, what do you mean moving out? They bought me out. I'm out. And they're like, they don't want any of this stuff. So he literally, he backed up Ryder truck, or back then it was probably U-Haul. U-Haul truck after U-Haul truck after U-Haul truck. He grabbed the full audio, lighting. There wasn't much video in the early 90s. All the bar equipment he could grab. Anything that wasn't like custom made into the building. Anything he could carry out. He left the furniture because he just didn't have the space. So then
the fixtures.
You fast forward about 15 years, 20 years. By then I'm living in, so it had to have been, about 20 years. I'm living in Vegas and I go back to visit. And my friends tell me about this new club that opened up downtown called Blue. And so mind you, this is 2002, 2003. And big club, three stories, super cool, multiple rooms. I'm like, at that point, I'm still clubbing a little bit. So I go and I walk in and the first thing I see are cyber lights. And I'm like, who the hell, where did they find brand new cyber lights? And then I look and I see some track spot ones, which had been discontinued in like 97 or something. And they look brand new too. And I'm looking around and I'm like, this is like a museum. this stuff reminds me a lot of the Guadalupe.
Right where it came from.
And I start looking around. I'm like, wait a minute. And so it turns out the guy running the club is Keith's son. And all this gear had just been sitting in a warehouse for 20-ish years. It was free. And the club failed miserably. So it's a good thing all the gear was free because it didn't last but like 3 months. But it was just funny. It was just funny that I walked in and I was like, holy cow. This is 1992, all over again. But yeah, when you mentioned that, Jan, I'm surprised somebody, why do they keep making that mistake? You don't put nightclubs under a movie theater. It's just
The Blues Club there. What was it? They had a bunch of them, big chain.
House of Blues.
House of Blues, right? Well, I did a bunch of corporate gigs in the Hollywood one, and that was a. They had a couple different PAs through the years.
Now, wait a second. Jan opened that place, and did Jan he? Had a lot to do with that place. A lot to do with that place. So go ahead.
I like that place. And then it went away, and I was really bummed, right? And then I did, for Video Apps, actually, I did a handful of shows, corporate shows, at the one in Anaheim after they moved it from Disney, because it was downtown Disney. They moved it over to the mall. In across the street, and yeah. I don't know. Had you ever, Kenny? What happened to you? No,
I didn't know that Anaheim House of Blues moved. That's funny.
It's in the mall, and you park in the bottom of the parking garage, and you can go right into the. And it's multi stories, and it had a Soundcraft. The big one there? What's it called?
VI6 or something.
It had a VI6. Yeah, and. I don't remember what speakers they had, but
it's like the House of Blues in Vegas is in the Mandalay Bay, kind of similar,
so,
I guess.
So if the console was a Soundcraft, then it was JBL speakers.
You know what? I think it was JBL speakers.
All the early House of Blues were 100% EV Dynacord.
In the beginning, yes, I remember. That's what I mean. When I first started to work in the Hollywood one.
The Hollywood one. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jan. Jan knows better than anybody. But wasn't it a Yamaha sound system?
It was absolutely Yamaha all the way, We put in Yamaha Wavefront speakers, and the most ineffective speakers And again, this is an opinion, but I don't believe Yamaha makes them anymore.
Sue Jan.
Well, that's because we got Yamaha to kick in the money. They had just come out with the, we just, I was the production manager of the House of Blues. And by the way, just an FYI.
I probably met you before when we were working there. I didn't even know it. How funny.
David and Kenny, I hired both of those guys to do the work on the install.
Oh my God. What a small world, man. It's just too funny.
Kenny did the initial design. And I finished the design and did the installation.
You didn't hire a licensed contractor? What the hell, dude?
Are you kidding?
No, we had a licensed contractor. We had a licensed contractor to do all the electrical. But as far as the sound goes...
What year did it open, Jan?
God, the 80s. No, the 90s. Early 94. 90s. Yeah. I mean, I remember that we did this. And the very first show that we had was with Aerosmith. It was Isaac Hayes opening for Aerosmith.
Wow.
And the Blues Brothers. That was the show. No, it was just Aerosmith and Isaac Hayes.
I went on a lot of dates there too. I took had some dinners and I did my time in the
you know that upstairs room, that private room that they had up there, you know, this private club.
Well, no, he had a lot of personal money.
A lot of. I got the hobnob with a lot of celebrities up there. You know, one of the guys I had working for me, he knew how hot it was, so he would pick up chicks and he would bring them up there, and I would get furious with him.
That's back when you looked like Frankie Valli.
Yeah, it was great having Jan as the production manager. He'd call up and say, come on down. Prince is going to show up later.
You know, that was Glam Slam. Are you talking about Glam Slam?
No, Prince came down.
The House of Blues, really?
Yeah.
So I have a technical question. Can I interrupt this great chat for a technical question?
Yeah.
Okay. Does anybody know? Okay, so it's a MIDI musical instrument digital interface related question. Does anybody know of a device with which I can send a control change out of it to the Digico console? The Digico console accepts certain sequence of control changes for recalling scenes. And I was wondering if anybody knows of a device that'll send a control change directly from the device.
And what would be your application on that?
To recall the scenes. So, like, for example, I have this thing called a Stream Deck. You know, you all know Stream Deck, right? So Stream Deck, but that has to go through the computer, and then the computer had a USB to MIDI interface and sends the MIDI signal, and that'll work. But I was wondering if there's any device with which I can send a programmable control change directly from a device. What do you know?
So without using a computer?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this will work probably, but it just seems overly complicated.
Wouldn't you just get that from a keyboard?
Like a musical keyboard, you mean?
A musical keyboard, yeah. Doesn't it have MIDI out?
Yeah, but how do you not that I want to carry a keyboard, but let's say I had a little miniature Casio keyboard.
What are they 12 keys across or whatever they are?
So my question is, can you program those like push buttons that are on there to be certain control changes instead of just what they are set to be? You can, Mike says.
That would be a musician question.
No, Mike seems
pretty confident.
Yeah, you got to stop controllers. Thinking about MIDI.
The green room.
As a musical thing, think about MIDI as a control protocol. And then it makes more sense. But I've used MIDI to recall lighting scenes.
Thank you.
I've used MIDI to recall to operate a sampler. I've used. Hang on a second. I think I actually have an example of this.
So if I get a $40 Casio MIDI keyboard that has a MIDI out,
it takes too much space. So
Kenny,
as it's programmable, because you're going to have to.
That's what I need. Yeah, I have to set the certain control string. Yeah, the certain control string. So that's what I have to figure out.
But I hear what you're saying about a keyboard, unless you're a musician and you can relate to keys.
But you want to label your scenes.
Yeah, well.
I only need four things. I only need four of the scenes, right? So yeah, go ahead. Not a program change. The box you're going to tell me about, I have a feeling, David, is the program changer.
What about that Yamaha thing, little box that you had from years ago?
Yeah, that's a MIDI program change device, not right. Control change. So it doesn't do control change, it does program change. Big difference. And the Digico responds to control changes, not program program changes. Go figure,
this
right?
This is to recall something in the Digico that the your fancy quantum Digico can't do. I mean, I find that hard to believe that you can't just
it does it, but I think what it's designed for is theatrical events where they're using QLab to do everything anyway, and QLab has no problem sending out control changes, and then so it'll fire that scene when they hit that sound cue, you know, or whatever.
Well, I think this might work for you. It's called the X Key Air, and it's a little bit bigger.
Does it have a MIDI? Does it have a MIDI output?
I believe it. It's Bluetooth, completely Bluetooth, and I believe you can control it through MIDI.
I need a MIDI, MIDI output. So, you know, I've got my computer and I've got MIDI interface.
What about using like a guitar pedal board switcher? There's all kinds of.
I'm sure that would work too. I'm sure that would work too.
You could just have
right. Actually, I'm wrong. It will hook into the computer. It does have a USB out.
Yeah, I don't need it to connect to the computer. That's the problem. Like the Stream Deck connects by USB also, but I prefer not to go through the computer. But yeah, you're right. A pedal board is probably my answer. Probably my answer.
Turn this off. Hang on. Let me get out of.
Let's share your screen.
Yeah, I'm just going to
get pedal board would be really cool idea.
Right.
Yeah, because Ken, you could even
that's why I'm asking, because like in the old days, like in the 90s, I programmed a pedal board to do control changes, but MIDI program changes. But I was wondering if you can program one of those pedal boards to do control changes.
Yes. Can you see this thing?
The Mastermind GT.
Yeah. So yeah, it's not like I need to be anywhere near that fancy.
No, but they make them smaller. That's like the big, crazy, elaborate one. But so RJM Mastermind, and they make smaller ones that would have like maybe six buttons, and it has continuous controller ports on the back, so you could plug a pedal into it if you needed something to change dynamically.
Yeah, I'm not looking for that. Of course, I just want control changes, and I want it to be a programmable.
That thing will do it all day long.
Control 16, one, you know?
Yep, that will do it all day long. And you don't need
to. Oh, cool. So it's RJM Mastermind. I'm going to try that. Thanks.
Yep.
It has a MIDI out right on it. It's not like I got to go through anything, right?
No, it's just that plugs into like any MIDI effects device or preamp or anything like that. There's no computer.
Cool. Awesome.
You can program it with a computer.
All right, thanks. And on that note, I got to go. But it's been nice. I really appreciate that info.
Where are you planning on using this? And why?
Well, okay. Oh, it's a long story, but
you got to go. All right.
Manilow Show. I'll tell you the Reader's Digest version. Manilow Show uses a lot of scenes. At least one scene for every song. More like two scenes for every song, right? And he's got a new show he's going to be doing, which we're calling the Clicker Tour. And with the Clicker, he's going to start a wheel spinning, and then the audience member is going to push another clicker. It's going to stop it from spinning. It's going to land on a song title. He's going to do that song. So parts of that's going to happen four times in the show. And so parts of the show are going to be random. So I have to be able to get to certain scenes very quickly and easily. So be able to get back to the regular set list after they select this random song. So it's going
to
be
to rig the wheel?
Yeah, that would be way easy. But let me tell you a story, quick story. In 97 was the first time he did this, 1997. And it was I forget what the name of the tour was, Reminiscing or something. But he did that same concept, but with technology from 1997. And it was totally planned. It was, don't tell anybody, okay? This isn't going anywhere, right? No, okay, no. Good. Yeah, so it was planned. It was planned to a point. Maybe they had 20 songs on the wheel, and they had only five were actually selectable or something. So the fans got a little aggravated that the fact that he only did these five songs or something like that. So the fans were a little aggravated. Well, let me tell you, he is really into it. So he said, "Listen, I'm not gonna chance it. We are going to be 100% random this time. It's going to be whatever we land on, that's what we're going to play. So it's not going to be at fixed at all. So that's why we all have to adapt to it. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to go adapt to some dinner.
Oh, before you go,
Ken,
before you go, just check the chat because there's some links there for you that Mike Brown put in.
Thanks. That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I have this chat set to save, so I'm going to save it. So thanks, you guys. Great talking to you. Thanks for that suggestion, Kurt, and I'm going to pursue that. It's going to be great. Thanks,
David.
Take care,
Ken. Bye-bye.
Well, we've been live an hour, and this hour is going by very, very fast.
Oh, it did. Flew by.
And we didn't even get to speak to I keep track of a lot of stories in case we get a lull in the action, but we don't have any lulls anymore. There's no lulls here. The one thing that I regret is that Dave Brown couldn't get his mic together to talk about the ham radio stuff. That I was looking forward to that. So maybe what we'll do is schedule him to come back and so that we could have him talk about that, because that's fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, he's got the Stargate right there. Why can't we all just go back to the beginning? Thank you, Fred. Thank you for paying attention.
Oh, you still there?
No, Ken's gone. But if you find something, I can send it to Jan, and Jan will send it to him.
I'd have a look at the Morningstar products.
Yeah, it was very cool. So, all right. Yeah. Well, we've been on for about an hour. Who's got something they want to say or ask me or whatever? Let's do that, and then we'll go offline and we'll just chat amongst ourselves.
So, do you remember the conversation that we had about the law in Australia? I think where when you finish your job, they're not allowed to call you afterwards. That your job is over when you leave the office, and they're not allowed to call you at 9 o'clock or Sundays or Mondays. We had that whole.
We're talking about last week.
Yeah. Well, I just LA paper today, a whole article, and it says this law already exists in Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, Italy, and in France. So it's been around for a long time. When you leave work, they have to leave you alone. So there, I just thought I'd bring that up.
Well, there you go. You also have a siesta time in Spain and Mexico, where they take time off during the middle of the day and not work. You know, look,
they do that in the Middle East too, during the hottest part of the day. So roughly 11 to 2, most shops just close there, because, and then everybody goes home and has a nice long lunch. Maybe they take a nap, maybe they don't, but then they'll come back and then they'll work till 6 or 7. So they still are working an 8 to 9 hour day. There's just a big chunk in the middle where it's hard to get anything done.
Yeah, I was in southern Spain and in Cadecas, where the Salvador Dali Museum is. And there's a really great hotel there called the Hotel Duran. And they have the best paella imaginable. So if you're ever in southern Spain near the French border, you want to go to the Hotel Duran. So we're down there. We went through the museum and did some shopping, and we're like, oh, you know, let's go have a paella lunch at the Hotel Duran. So we walk over to the hotel and it's like, yes, we'd like to, you know, have lunch. And she's like, well, you'd like to reserve lunch. And I said, yeah, we'd like to reserve lunch. And I said, great. How many are there? So we're just two. And they're like, great. What, you know, well, what time would you like to come? We're ready to sit down now. And it was like, between 12 and 12:30. And she burst out laughing, right, saying, the chef doesn't show up until 1:30. The soonest that you could possibly be seated in the dining room is 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
You needed to explain to them that you were hungry like a wolf.
Duran. Good joke, buddy. Excellent.
That's very good. Very quick. Very quick.
Bravo, Kurt.
See what you missed all these times.
It's good to have you back, guys. It's good to all have you. So who hasn't said anything much that's been in the room? Let's see. We've heard from everybody.
So how's Thailand?
I'll tell you what. Thailand's amazing. It's just amazing. I just want to, I just have to say a couple of things that I would like to share online. case Bo or her family is listening, you know, may her brother Tong rest in peace. He passed away yesterday.
Sorry.
47 years old. You know, hardworking guy, really nice guy. I had lunch. You know, it's funny. I had lunch with him the other day, like less than a week ago, actually on Friday, and he passed away yesterday. So, and the interesting thing was he was saying that it was too hot to eat at this point in time, and he didn't want to eat with us. So we brought him some lunch, and he just said, look, it's too hot for you guys to hang out here. I'm going to go back. He drove an oil truck. And he was at the harbor waiting for his load. Turns out that we were there about 12 o'clock in the afternoon. His load didn't happen till 10 o'clock at night. And but he's been so basically it was really hard for him on the heat. But really super nice guy. Never spoke a word of English to me. I have no idea what he would have said. And I my tie is so limited. You know, all I could say is, well, why poke in my, which means I'll see you again, you know, and that's it. I never got to see him again. So may you rest in peace. Also, another thing I want to bring up is that Michael Gladstone, David, Michael had passed away how many years ago now?
Five years, I think.
Yeah, and his birthday was April 5th. So I want to wish him, you know, a happy birthday, and may he rest in peace as well. A talented guy that, you know, those that knew him, well, that's all I'll say, those that knew him. David, you want to say anything about that or no?
Oh, he was unique. He was talented.
Unique is a word, yes, unique.
You know, you either loved him or hated him.
Unique. I saw there's a picture of me and him on Facebook right now that I posted that took place back in the 70s, mid 70s. If you want to see, you know, what it looks like to be really stoned out hippie, you go check out that picture of me.
one of the fun stories, it's kind of typical of Michael. He was a tour manager for Pablo Cruz, and they were opening for the Doobie Brothers. And he was doing, you know, he was a talented guy. He did a lot of things, lighting, sound, but he also rubbed people the wrong way. And at the end of the tour, they tarred and feathered him with honey. All in good spirit, but still, they tarred and feathered the guy.
Listen, I speak from experience that even when it's done in good spirit, that stuff takes a couple of days to fully get rid of. That honey, especially if they were smart enough to warm it up a little bit, yeah, it pretty much goes everywhere.
Yeah. I think that's what they use in the Brazilian wax aspect, some honey. I think that's how it works. I don't know. I can't remember. It's been a while. Anyway, listen, thanks for coming, everybody. We're going to stay in the room. If you want to join us, DM any one of us, and we'll send you a link on how to join. Dave Brown, seriously, get your mic fixed and come on back in. We really would love to have you and talk about some ham radio stuff. A little aside, when I was 13 years old, I was an FCC technician class licensee. I was a ham radio operator. So CQ. Calling CQ. With that, we will say 73, 62, and even. Remember, you make it happen. Everything you heard today is an opinion, so do your own research. Next week will be our 204th show. These are the
disclaimers.
So come and join us. and bring your stories. I think it was Mike Brown that said, is this a good idea? I think that's going to be the next theme for the show. Is it a good idea? So that's what we'll be talking about. And until then, you make it happen. Have a great week, everybody. And we're off the air.
Yeah, I've got a good idea. So what you do is you take a pan and you heat peanut oil really, really hot. And then you throw an ice cube in it. Not a good idea.